I used to see her quite frequently, but I mean, I always, you know, saw her on business connected with her own kind of area. You remember we ran an enormous kind of British cultural festival in 77, it seems ironic now, biggest thing we've ever mounted in any overseas country ever. And I had a lot to do with her over that, and, you know, various things like, you know, republication of books and the Cambridge History of Iran, and, you know, a lot of things of that kind. But I don't think I ever really had a serious political conversation with her. Not that I can think of. So I really don't know. I just don't know what their relationship was in that sense. Certainly people used to say that there were only two people in the country who could really talk openly to the Shah. I mean, one was, you know, word was Asadar Alam and the other was her. Maybe that's so. I also thought towards the end that the same might have been true of Manoohar Paul. But he also, of course, died at the wrong time.
There was, you mentioned in your book, as Abdullah Iqtizam. Well, I mean, he was one of those elder statesmen who were extremely shrewd, extremely intelligent, highly cultured, and a very good man, knowing exactly what to do. But apparently he couldn't have his ear any longer. What he said to me was that he couldn't even have the ear of Hoveyda, who was his great disciple, friend.
Yeah.
And that once or twice he had approached that things, and he had just changed the subject of the conversation. So in retrospect, it seems so tragic that all these really good, intelligent, clever, experienced men should have been set aside for a lot of very mediocre, newfangled guys from 10th rate doctorates, 20th-rate American universities, sort of thing.
Of course, that was one of the things I remember which struck me most forcefully when I got used to the country, when I'd been there a bit, was how by really not destroying, but by neutralizing the traditional political establishment of the country, landowners, senior Bazaaris, people like that, religious leaders, as it seems, how totally kind of unpolitical the whole setup seemed to me to be. That there was the Shah, and then there were a group of people who, in British terms, would have been regarded really as permanent officials, not politicians. Amir Abbas, and the whole cabinet. Some of them were men of brilliant intellect and great ability and devotion to their work. But the one thing one always noticed was, about them, talking to them, was that none of them had any political constituency in the country at all. Most of them had spent more of their lives abroad than they had in Iran. And somebody like Fereydoon Mahdavi, for example. What was his name? The Minister of Industry, was a very clever man. But often we used to joke about it in the embassy that most of the cabinet ministers knew more about the political situation in Britain than they did about the political situation in Iran, you know. More greater experts on the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party in Britain probably than we were. And, you know, really didn't seem to be even interested in the politics of their country. It seemed to be a kind of non-political scene. And the impression I got, really, was that the only kind of old-fashioned political figure with an old-fashioned feel for the country who was in direct touch with the Shah was Alam, who, as it were, had very deep roots in a certain part of Iran and was really part of an older establishment than all these technocratic ministers who comprised the cabinet and so on.
Of course, probably the argument behind his stance was that if Iran was becoming a modern country, needed the young blood and needed the new people from the West, Western educated, and that the old guard had to gradually, let the others take over.
Yes, I think this was his philosophy. Of course, I think it was compounded by the emasculation of the Parliament. I mean, if the Parliament had been able, the Parliament, after all, did contain people with constituencies of a kind. I mean, local people who had some roots in their constituencies and so on, even though they may have been carefully selected. I mean, they must have known a great deal more of what was going on than these technocratic ministers did. I mean, if they'd been free, without, actually blocking the Shah's policy, to express their views, and if some of the senior ones had had access to the Shah and so on, he might have got a better feel, as it were, of the country through them. And I think it was understandable. I mean, if you were trying, say, to transform the whole, system of distribution of goods within the country, it was better to have somebody in charge of that who really knew his stuff than some political figure. And all that was reasonable enough. Really, except for Alam, I mean, I remember thinking this at a very early stage. I mean, there was just absolutely nobody from the old establishment who seemed to me to have any voice in affairs at all. Haveda himself, of course, was the nearest to that, because he did get around and see people and all the rest of it, but I don't think he had the access to the Shah.
And some people say that he survived simply because he never rocked the boat.
I think his philosophy, as stated to me on many occasions, was there are lots of things about the way the country is run that I don't like, but I can't think of a better regime than we've got now, and therefore it is my duty to make it work as best I can. Which, of course, in our British terms, is really the attitude of an official and not of a politician. I mean, as a lifelong official, I mean, my duty, so long as there isn't a policy which is so repugnant to me that I resign, is to argue my case, accept the decision that the politicians make, and then try and carry it out in the best possible way. I mean, that, to me, is the duty of an official. And that, I think, is how all these cabinet ministers, including Haveda, conceived their duty. Not to get involved in the actual politics of the whole thing.
It must have made the Shah very lonely at
times. I think it did. I think it did make him very lonely. I mean, for example, one of the things I quote in my book, you see, when the Shah suddenly decided that the whole bread manufacture and distribution system in the country should be transformed from its traditional condition into kind of mother's pride sliced bread a la Europe or America. I then suppose that Peridun Mahdavi, who was responsible for this, found himself in a position to explain the politics of this to the Shah in terms of the country. He just went away and did his best to make it work. Whereas in our system, the politicians would have argued amongst themselves as to whether this was going to fly in terms of public opinion and pressure groups. If they decided that it was, then the officials would have been told to go and do it. If they decided that it wasn't, it wouldn't have been attempted, as it were. But I don't think that process ever happened.
Well, that accounts for the fact also that he was so acharné about the left wing and left the right wing completely without any supervision, really, as it were.
Yes, I think that is so. Yes, I think that is so.
Because he tolerated a lot of corruption and things. He forgave a lot of people when they did wrong. He was much tougher with the left, I mean, with so-called pro-communist or communist or what have you.
Yes, I agree, and I must say we never thought, you see. I mean, in spite of the occasional terrorism and that kind of thing, I don't think we, the Western diplomats, I mean, not just us, the British, but when we discussed it with each other, I don't think we really ever thought that the Tudeh Party was a serious threat to actually take over the country. And we saw it as being strong in certain areas, non-existent in others, fairly weak in others, but it didn't have a kind of national presence which would have been able to take over. And we always thought there was far too much emphasis being put on really paper tigers, as it were.
And nobody told him this.
So it seems.
It was very sad, of course, but there you are. So let us go back to the... Did you have any idea that Shah was ill?
No. I mean, we picked up, as everybody did, the rumours that used to circulate just about every year, you know, about visits to Vienna and doctors being flown in and all the rest of it. But, and, you know, I always used to take these very seriously, and I used to investigate them, and I used to report about them, and so on. But so far as I was concerned, I could only deal with what I could see. And on the face of it, I mean, the Shah, who was roughly my age, 2 or 3 years older, perhaps, I mean, always seemed to me, on the face of it, to be a man in very good physical shape. I mean, he rode a lot, he skied a lot, he played tennis a lot, he looked well, he had a good colour, he wasn't losing weight. All the kinds of the classical symptoms to a layman of somebody who is ill were not present. And I always used to discount these stories. And I do believe, I'm no doctor, that, I don't know, morale has a tremendous effect on physical illness. I mean, if the revolution had not happened, if everything was still going fine in Iran, I guess the Shah would probably still be alive. I mean, he might have had a long, very long-term kind of wasting illness. Many people have that, but I think it was precipitated, as it were, by the collapse. I don't really believe, although an awful lot of my friends would contradict this, that it was actually a serious factor in the revolution. Certainly, as far as I was concerned, I mean, right up to the very end, he seemed to me to be wholly lucid and in control of himself, and not really showing any signs of this physical malaise. I know other people did see him not in that condition. Only on one occasion did he seem to me to be ill.
When was that?
In September. I remember going to see him one day, and he looked awful and couldn't concentrate, and he looked yellow and so on. I thought, my God, there's something terrible wrong with that fellow. But I saw him again 36 hours later, and he was absolutely okay.
But of course, this is one of the mysteries that one doesn't know about cancer, what effect it has on the general...
Yes, on the kind of personality. Yes, I quite agree. I quite agree. But certainly, strange though it may seem, I don't think any of us, the Americans ourselves, you know, the leading foreign countries, I don't think any of us really knew, as it were, that he was as ill as he appeared, as he ultimately obviously was.
I wonder whether, do you know, when you say you investigated the rumors about him being ill and doctors coming over and so on, how did you do that? And what was
well,
that?
I would ask around of people who might know, you know. I mean, I would say quite openly, you know, people at the court and that kind of thing, you know, I hear, you know, Shah's gone off in medical treatment to Vienna, something, is there something wrong, and all the rest of it, and they would discuss it quite openly, you know, but they would say he was having a check-up, or, you know, he had something, and, but he did have this back trouble, you see, the whole time. You know, when you were sitting talking to him, he was always kind of moving about in his chair, you know, like this, something, he was kind of uncomfortable, he had this back trouble, which lots of people do, of course. Things like that. And, of course, if I may say so without giving offense, I think Iranians are not hypochondriacs. I mean, very much obsessed with their health. I mean, they're always having checkups every 5 minutes and that kind of thing. And I don't think I've ever had a checkup in my life. You know, it kind of wasn't surprising that he should be kind of seeing doctors and the doctors should be coming to see him and that kind of thing. It didn't seem to be a remarkable phenomenon. And then, you see, I saw him so relatively frequently, and I used to ski a lot at the scene, and he was often there, you know, skiing away like mad.
I wonder whether he was told the truth.
Ah, indeed, of course, that one doesn't matter.
Because, you see, behavior towards the very end, I think, gives me the idea that maybe he didn't know completely what the truth was, because if you have cancer in the lymphatic glands is like having it in the blood. I mean, it just goes around your body. There's no way of, I mean, you can protract the decay, but you can't really stop it. And so if you knew that that was the case, maybe he would have said, well, what have I got to lose? I'm going to stick it out and see what they do to me or what will happen. And instead of saying, well, you know, I leave and see what they do. I wonder whether they didn't, until the last minute, as they got so used to hiding the truth.
You see, if he'd this is a speculation, of course, but if he'd really known that he was dying in the timescale that eventually turned out to be the case, and if he'd really believed in his own mind that his own judgment and personality was being impaired by his illness, I would have thought the obvious thing to have done, which might, of course, even have defused the revolution, would have been to have abdicated, say, in the summer of 1978, and in favour of his son, to create a completely new atmosphere in the country, and maybe that would have defused it. I don't think he would have hesitated to do that simply because he wanted to cling to power, because I think he was a patriotic man. But in all the conversations I had with him, you know, right up to the bitter end, I mean, nothing like this was ever mentioned.
This is the second session with Sir Anthony Parsons. We just carry on from where we left it last time. Today is the 7th of March, 1985. So I think this is running now. Well, I put it in front of you, and you can speak to any, you know, I think it doesn't need any particular arrangement. Now, this is our second session, and I have got a few extra questions, you know, carrying on from where we were last time. One of them is that, obviously, you had lots of friends in Persian, you were very popular, and you reciprocated. I mean, there are lots of friends that you liked there, and you generally had great sympathy for the country. But did this sympathy extend to the political setup of the regime and the court? Because apparently some Iranians thought that you were rather critical, without saying anything, but you were rather critical of the system. And particularly Lady Parsons was rather critical of the system.
Well, I suppose it is true to say that having spent a great deal of time in the Arab world, where whatever the failings of government may be, the general atmosphere is very cozy, to use an English word, a particularly English expression, I think I did find the court very protocolaire, rather stiff, and as it were, remote from the people as a whole. This doesn't mean I didn't have many close friends in the court, but the general atmosphere of the court I found unfamiliar in my experience. The system itself, I was enormously impressed with the majority of the people who were operating the system, the political system. My main feeling about that was, I mean, my main criticism of it was that it seemed to me, right from the moment I arrived there, that it was too technocratic and not political enough. That is to say that very few of the ministers seemed to me to have any political constituency or real understanding of what was going on at the grassroots of the country. They were enormous experts on their own subjects, whatever they might have been. But they were acting, as it were, as if they were operating their system in, say, Western Europe or the United States, and they didn't seem to have a kind of grassroots feel for their own people. That was my criticism of the system.
Yes. Of the people generally, I mean, what you really are saying is what a lot of people are saying, that there was sort of tremendous class division. Those who were educated were saying they had a kind of disrespect almost for their own people.
Yes, I mean, a lack of understanding in a sense. I mean, I've been used to politicians in my own country and indeed politicians in other countries I've served in, who may not have been great intellectual giants, may not have been particularly expert on their own portfolios, if they were technical ones, but they had officials to supply that need, and their task was to know what actually would fly with the people and what wouldn't fly. I mean, they were closely in touch with the people. And although something might seem theoretically a marvelous idea, they had this link with their own people which made them know whether or not this would actually be acceptable, whether it would make things worse or whether it would make things better in the general political sense. This element I found lacking. It seemed to me that the Shah and the cabinet were running the state rather like a large corporation, as it were, with a limited number of shareholders, regardless actually of the masses as a whole.
Yes, but what you're saying really is the fundamental question of democracy, because in a democracy politicians have to have some kind of they have to be answerable to the people, otherwise they don't get re-elected.
Not entirely. I mean, for example, in Iraq under the monarchy, where I was 30-odd years ago, you couldn't have called it a democracy, although the country went through the forms of democracy. I mean, there were elections and so on, but they were hopelessly rigged, and it was just an interchange of jobs amongst a small group of insiders. But that group of insiders comprised people who had roots deep in the population. I mean, tribal grandees and provincial landowners and people like that, who, although their views might have been misguided, were kind of part of their own constituencies. They had a feel for their people. Even though there was no genuine democracy in the sense that we understand it in this country. If you take a more traditional Arab society, you know, like, say, the small states of the Persian Gulf, I mean, there isn't democracy there in the sense that the government can't actually be thrown out or anything like that. But the rulers are in very close day-to-day touch with the people as a whole. Anybody can go and see the sheikh in a small society like Bahrain, where I was for many years. It was this element that I found lacking. The government seemed to be operating, as it were, in a kind of, not exactly in a vacuum, because it had its own constituency amongst the highly educated and richer classes, but it seemed to me to be cut off from the people as a whole, and therefore a lot of the measures that they were adopting, although theoretically excellent in terms of kind of MIT models, as it were totally alien to or totally unacceptable, as it were, to the people as a whole. I mean, that was my criticism of the system, more than the fact that it wasn't actually a kind of model democracy on Westminster lines. Iran is Iran and England is England.
That's right, yes. Because the democracy on the Westminster line is the fact that ministers are chosen among the MPs, so they have to have constituencies,
yes,
at least
exactly.
In their own regions.
Exactly.
Whereas it seemed to me that in Persia only Tom, Dick and Harry could be called a minister.
Yes, I think that's quite right. I mean, you see, in England now, for example, I mean, I suppose even the Prime Minister spends at least half a day every week in her own parliamentary constituency. I mean, actually keeping in touch with the people who elected her, as it were. And even in her position, it's very important that she does that. I mean, this keeps her in touch with the people at a mass level, the people who are interested in politics. This seemed to me to be totally lacking in Iran. And then the court, as I said, I mean, the court seemed to me even more remote. It was a kind of glittering affair, you know, which didn't really seem to me to be a part of the Iranian scene somehow.
Yes. Is that why, I mean, where, how did the rumor get around that Lady Parsons was rather critical?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, I mean, my wife is a very outspoken person, more so than I am, and I think she did find it, and I think we both found the court, I can't quite think of exactly the right word, I mean, very stiff, very protocolaire, very hierarchical. Everybody seemed to be afraid of the person immediately above them, and rather being rather tough with the person immediately below them, as it were. And, you know, it wasn't very attractive in that sense. It wasn't a very genial atmosphere.
Yes. What about did Lady Barsanov friends among Persian women?
Oh, Lord, yes, masses. And she had lots and lots of friends. And indeed amongst a lot of the ladies, the wives and people at the court. It was really the structure as a whole. And we had great friends in the court. And we used to, well, the, oh dear, his name's gone out of my head, Shireen, he was a vice minister of the court,
what period?
Mid-70s. He went to be ambassador in Australia or New Zealand or somewhere like that.
That was when Mr. Allen was minister.
And
he was the second in command, as it were, and his wife.
Yes, he was the next one down. I simply can't remember. His name begins with Alice, but I can't remember. Yes. But they were great friends of ours. But of course, when they were in our house and we were all relaxed, I mean, they were different people to what they were in the environment of the court. This was something we weren't really used to.
But have you ever been to the court here? Wouldn't that be a little bit protocolaire?
Well, yes, I mean the court here is protocolaire, but of course the difference, I suppose, is this, that the court here is symbolic and ceremonial, whereas the court in Iran was actually very much an integral part of the government of the country. And this is the distinction. I mean, courts, monarchical courts, are almost by their nature rather protocolaire and rather stiff. But of course, if they're purely symbolic and ceremonial, presentational, that's one thing. But if they're actually part of the government of the country, that's something else.
Yes. Was Lady Parsons critical of Persian women in the way they behaved, or in the way they, you know, they dressed, the way they acted, or the way...
Well, I think again, both of us found, and particularly probably my wife, that it wasn't exactly, I mean, it was a very class-conscious society in those days, and I don't think we're very class-conscious people, that there was a very kind of stringent social hierarchy and so on, which makes, in our view, I think, for some kind of artificiality. I think having been in the Islamic world so long, my wife particularly was rather shocked by the kind of un-Islamic attitude of a lot of the ladies.
In what way?
Well, you know, the kind of disregard of Ramadan and, you know, and all that kind of thing. And I think she found it rather odd, rather strange that this should be the case in a Muslim country.
They were so westernized, didn't they?
Yes, I mean, they were kind of, in a way, aggressively westernized. And I think what my wife found was that, I mean, for example, when we were in Egypt, educated, westernized Egyptian ladies, were still at the same time very good Muslims. I mean, they always fasted in Ramadan, they always, you know, went through all the motions and so on, went to the mosque and so on and so forth. And I think to find this, again, total divorce from the country's traditions amongst the upper classes, it was rather odd. It was kind of surprising to us.
Yes.
I mean, our previous experience of your part of the world had been, 4 or 5 years in Turkey, which is a very, I mean, Republican Turkey is an extremely informal country, very, very informal country, very little kind of stiffness of any kind. Also, in spite of Atatürkism and so on, a very religious country. Even in the 1950s, you know, the mosques on a Friday were fuller in Ankara than they would have been, say, in Cairo. And this went right up and down the past structure. The Arab world, of course, much more traditional. I think we were kind of surprised, you know, it was something very alien to our experience. And when we'd been there a short time, we realized, of course, that this was very much a function of the upper westernized class, and it was quite different from the Iranians we met at a different level.
Now, I, although I find that your wife's attitude understandable insofar as she noticed a difference, I wonder why it shocked her. I mean, it seems to me that the reason why Persians, when they become educated, they become very religious. My own interpretation is that because they're fundamentally not very congenial. I mean, Islam is not fundamentally very congenial to the Persian psyche. They really are very different from the Arabs. I feel that it's something that has never stuck, hence all the troubles. I mean, as you know, all the heresies in Islam. I've come from Persia. There must be some reason for it. And to my mind, Islam is that fundamentally Persians would be much, much happier as Christians or as Zoroastrians, let's say, than they are as Muslims. And so when they become educated, the first thing they share, so to speak, is the appearance of Islam. I don't know why Lady Parsons should be shocked by this.
No, I think perhaps I've used Islam in too narrow a sense. I think really what we felt was, shocked again perhaps is the wrong word, I think what we both felt, and perhaps my wife more than me, was that in England, for example, if you have, say, a landowner, obviously he has a different level of education and a different accent probably to the people who are actually living on his estate. But in their tradition, there is common ground, as it were. They've kind of kept in touch, although there is obviously a social hierarchy. The same is true in urban society to a great extent. I think what we felt was that there obviously was a very deep traditionalism with which Islam is strongly associated, of course, in general terms in Iran, and that the upper classes in our time seem to us to be divorced not only from the religion of the people, maybe that's not so important, I rather agree with you there, but also from the kind of general tradition. I mean, they seem to be totally different people.